Michael John Atkins. Thank you, sir.
Honourable Chairman, honourable members, thank you. I'm here as a, basically as a citizen. I'm a self-employed IT consultant. You might dislike me even more if I say this, but I used to be a mathematics teacher. And what I did last week, I have had an interest in the subject over a number of years. I'm an amateur legal enthusiast, if you like. I am motivated by legal and constitutional issues and how they impact our society. I have a desire and a passion to see laws written well. I noted a comment right at the beginning of the day that a law should be comprehensible and it should be enforceable. So that, that sort of was quite succinct in summing up how I look at issues. Through my submissions, well, what I said I did last week, I sat down and I looked at the bill and I looked at the Principal Act. And I just had a jolly good read through it, looking at the language. My wife says I'm very picky and pedantic. But I just said, okay, let's sit down and have a really good look at this to see what I come up with. Some of the things I have to say are very minor observations, and some of them have a little bit more meat to them, but I'm trying to come from a point of view of logically working the things through. I would be delighted if any of my observations were of assistance to the committee in their deliberations. I also realise that the situation has been complicated by the Act being enacted and enforced and then the Constitutional Court case. So if I've missed a couple of the facts in my focus on the details, please forgive me. Firstly, I'm interested in the status of regulations. And my reading of the amendment bill means that if it is passed as it is, the minister would not have the power to make regulations. For the simple reason that that power is replaced with a power for the MECs to make regulations. Many people have spoken of this, and I'm not saying whether that's a good or a bad thing. I'm making the observation. And every act that I've looked at, and I did work for a legal publisher for a number of years, every act that I've looked at where the minister makes regulations, it says that the minister makes regulations. So if it no longer says that, then I'd argue that the minister would no longer be entitled to make regulations. Fair enough, the MECs can do it. But the minister operates obviously at a national level, whereas the MECs operate within their own their respective provinces. So what would the status of the existing body of national regulations be? The day the Act is passed and the minister may no longer make regulations, well then he wouldn't have the power to rescind any of those regulations either, because that's inherent in the power to make them or amend them. Now you don't want a situation where you have a body of regulations that last forever untouchable. Sort of a biblical reference of the laws of the Medes and the Persians that can't be altered. So I submit that those regulations would have to be repealed on the last day of the before the new Act came into force. But the provincial MECs would need to be pretty snappy about promulgating sufficient regulations in each of their provinces. And the most important one is the issue of the prescribed training. If there is a day that exists where a particular province does not have a regulation about training, if the amendment bill is passed as it stands, then I submit to you that no termination by a registered midwife or nurse would be lawful in that province on that day. Okay, it's a technical thing, and I'm not saying you must decide any differently with what you want to do. I'm trying to point out an implication. Because those abortions by registered nurses and midwives are only lawful if those people have carried out prescribed training. Now, they may well have been trained beforehand and previously under training that's prescribed. But if there is a day when there is no training prescribed in that province, then there are no registered midwives who have undergone the prescribed training because there is no prescribed training. Now, it's a very picky little point. So all I'm saying is, be very careful if you do transfer the powers away from the minister to the MECs, that you do not leave a gap in which any terminations carried out by registered nurses and midwives would then be unlawful. You do not want to to criminalise a whole section of your workforce because of a miscalculation. Right. So that was my points number one and two. A very small point. In the financial implications at the end of the bill, it says that there are no major implications, and all they mention is a slight increase in the number of terminations at each state facility. We've heard a lot that there is an anticipated increase in the number of people who would provide terminations, being the registered nurses. Now, I don't know how long the prescribed training is, but if you take a registered nurse out of service, is it a month? Is it 2, 3, 4 months? Whatever it is, effectively the training costs that nurse's salary for the time that they're under training and not working. Not to mention the people providing the training. And I would respectfully suggest to the committee that you do some sums as to the numbers of people you expect to train over what period, and you do the costing of the training and put that into the financial implications of the bill before you take it to the House. And look, these are details, but right, then, as I said, my wife says I'm very fussy about details. Now, this is almost embarrassing to mention it. In the proposed section 3.5, it talks about the minister being able to perform actions that the MEC can do if it is necessary. Now, just a comment. Surely that doesn't belong under a heading, places where terminations of pregnancy may take place. Why don't you make that a section in its own right or a subsection somewhere else? Because it has application to the whole Act, not merely to that particular subsection. And just a point with the regulations, I've argued in writing that you couldn't interpret that subsection as empowering the minister to make regulations. If the minister can do anything an MEC can do, the MEC can make provincial regulations. You can't transfer that to the minister and say, well, that's making national regulations. Okay, so little details. Now, in proposed section 10, right, there's a little logic error. Now, please forgive me for being the one to point this out. I studied computer science at university, and we did this kind of thing in first year. It's in proposed section 10.1d. It says, terminate a pregnancy or allow the termination of pregnancy at a facility, and there's two logical conditions, but they've both got nots in front of them. Not approved in terms of section 3.1 or not contemplated in section 3.3a. That or should be an and. Okay, it's a very minor thing, but it logically makes quite a big difference. And I can explain why this way. Let's say everyone in the room is about to have some nice fast food. Okay, I always use hamburgers with my 10-year-old son. He always understands any explanation I give if I mention hamburgers. So let's say, you say, right, who wants hamburgers? Group of people get hamburgers. Who wants hot dogs? Another group of people get hot dogs. Now you want to hand out Kentucky chicken, all right? Anyone who has not had a hamburger and has not had a hot dog may come and get Kentucky. Now, if you want to exclude both groups, so if you want to exclude both, you've got to say not that one and not the other one. Because if you say not that one or not this one, all the hamburger people haven't had hot dogs, so they'll claim the Kentucky. And all the hot dog people haven't had hamburgers, so they'll also claim the Kentucky. Okay, so just I'm sorry to belabor the point, but it's a little thing that makes a big difference. And you wouldn't want to be hauled before a court of law in a technicality like that. Right, a small point, withdrawal of approval by the MEC. All I was noticing in where the MEC may withdraw approval, you differed from how the minister treated the original, in the original, in the principal act as it stands now. That's handled differently from the way the minister treated the withdrawal. Now, the minister had to give 14 days notice in the Gazette, and maybe it's too cumbersome, maybe you need to close a place down sooner. But I've got it in writing. I'm just suggesting that you tighten it up. That it's not just, there's no provision. The original act had very clear prescription for the minister. He had to do it by notice in the Gazette. And perhaps you might have something that the MEC would need to do it in writing with a notice in the Gazette, you know, at least to follow, however you want to draft that. But then something which has a little bit more... sorry, I missed this earlier. My number three. The terminology in the proposed section 3.1. Okay. There's that word, and a few people alluded to it, the give access to. I'm a person who annoys people by how precise I am with my terminology. That's a relatively vague term. Now, perhaps you need it to be vague. Sometimes laws need a little bit of elasticity in them, and the courts would apply all the normal interpretation of statutes in that case. But the gives access to, and people have spoken of it, could be a problem. Somebody, and I forget who, said when a problem occurs, it occurs quickly. So if a doctor is, you have access to a doctor, and that doctor's at a hospital across town, 3 kilometres away. Okay, that's not really across town in places like Joburg or Cape Town. Okay, then Durban's a small town. So at 4:45 in the afternoon, that 3 kilometres is 45 minutes. Okay, so that would be an extreme. The access to transport. Surely that is not having the phone number of a taxi driver pasted on the wall where you've got an agreement with him that when you need to take someone, he'll bring his taxi and he'll take the patient there. Okay. Now, I'm not being insulting. I don't mean to be disrespectful to anyone. That's an extreme. That's a ridiculous case. And obviously it can't mean those things. But does it mean that the doctor is on the premises 24 hours? Or in the hours of operation? I don't know. But I suggest that you tighten up that to be fair to both the facility, that you're not being too onerous in your requirements on them, and to the women who go to that facility, that you're not so lax that they're not able to access the care that you need. I've thought about it, you know, like would across the road for a doctor or some of the other things be valid? Well, you have to think about it. It's just you cannot leave it completely loose. Sorry, I had one more point there, so I just want to consult my notes. Okay, I won't say any more there. Right. Now, I had section 8, and it's been partly answered in, I think, in a lot of the discussions. We come to the issue of the 24-hour facilities. Right. Now, what the Act is doing, I'm a little puzzled. It's coming along and it's saying, okay, places with 24-hour maternity services just don't have to apply for approval. Reading it at face value, I'm puzzled. Because they do have to submit notice that they have a 24-hour facility. And if terminations are performed there, then they do have to submit all the stats. What have those facilities benefited by that act of just not having to apply? Now, okay, somebody did answer. I didn't know, and I was quite shocked that it could take 6 months or a year to be designated. So maybe that is a potential benefit. But for a tiny amount of paperwork saving, I don't know why, or it's not apparent from the bill, why a special clause should be inserted. Particularly given the provisional clause that facilities already designated will be deemed to have been approved. So I would just propose, unless there is a good reason why you keep it in, I propose take it out, because you don't want to have unnecessary or fairly redundant clauses in your legislation. Right. As a general comment, the safety of the women. I watched the debate in 1996 on television, and the preamble to the Principal Act talks about the safety of the women. And a very positive comment, any attempt to enshrine in legislation that there are standards for facilities where terminations take place, to my mind, obviously have to be welcomed, and it's a very constructive move. Sorry, I've got notes going all around my page. I followed the debate on the non-mandatory counselling, and I think it's pretty much been hammered out. I would just maybe make an observation. The people who have said, don't include it, you don't need to include it, I don't believe I've heard a single argument raised as to why it would be harmful to include such a thing. And it was pointed out earlier that the Civil Unions Act has a similar thing. I think one Professor Mahlanga said, oh, well, then you'd have to include it in all the other acts. But that's not showing a specific harm to it. So I don't think that I'm confusing two things, and I'm sorry, it's late in the day. I'm moving from the counselling to the conscience clause, and I apologise. On the subject of the conscience clause, which is what I actually then talked about, okay. The people who objected to it did not advance a reason why it would cause harm. So I just pose the situation to you. You've had some concerns raised that the NCOP did not take a single item of public submission into account. Now, I'm not accusing this body after 2 long days of not taking our submissions into account. As a citizen, it really feels good to be here. But maybe, if there's no specific harm in including it, the inclusion of it would demonstrate in a concrete way that the committee and parliament had indeed taken into account public sentiment on the matter. Given that, and unless you have any serious objection to putting it in. So I'm just sort of positioning it. On the counselling subject, yes, that was hammered out. Clearly the National Health Act requires that there's counselling for medical procedures. Or I would suggest it's probably not a good idea for another act to introduce confusion. And I thought of two possible areas of wording that you could possibly consider if you wish to make it more consistent. One would be that the state will ensure the provision of non-mandatory, non-directive counselling. Doesn't mean they have to do it, but they must ensure that it is available. And that was the sentiment that most people took as to what actually went on. And I'd submit that if you could clarify it that way, if you can clarify it, and now's your chance. This, I believe, is the First Amendment to the Principal Act since 1996. Then I suggest, why not do it? I can't think of my other wording, but you know, you can apply your minds, obviously, to those issues. Right. The issue... Right, sorry, I'm jumping around in my notes. In the objects of the bill, in object G, it says, make it an offence for any person to terminate a pregnancy unlawfully or allow a termination of a pregnancy at a facility which has not been approved. Okay? That's, again, laudable, the issue of an enforceable piece of legislation. I think people don't respect the law if the law can't be enforced. Now, I'd like to point out two areas which fall into this. One has been mentioned already, and that is if a medical practitioner carries out a termination after 20 weeks for a reason other than those allowed. That is currently not an offence. Right? If the object of the... But it is unlawful. Right? If the object of the act is specifically to make any unlawful terminations an offence, then I submit to you that you have a duty to include the medical practitioner after 20 weeks who does so for a reason other than those stipulated. Then the other one is a very small one, and I'm going to have to refer to my notes because it is late. Okay, I think in number 12. Okay, I've actually written it in number 12, and I'm sorry. Okay, then it might be one of the others. Just please bear with me for just a moment while I try and understand my own notes. Okay, there was another small unlawfulness which arose that wasn't covered in the proposed section 10.1d. And I'm sorry, I've gone blank now. I'm not going to retrieve it. The logic of that's not quite complete. I'd like to just make an observation from personal experience. There was a comment made about a suggestion that you separate facilities for terminations and for maternity. Now, I'm not coming with a strong doctrinaire position on this. My wife, with one of our children, had started to have contractions at about 26 weeks. And she went into hospital for observations. And we were quite distressed because she was going to go into a facility where there were mothers with babies. And I just asked the question because I don't know. Because just imagine if she'd lost our baby, and she'd been in the same room as mothers with babies. And I posed the question, and maybe the people within the hospitals will know better than me. Will you have a situation where women who have just undergone terminations will be alongside women giving birth, or who have just given birth? On a personal level, whatever your view is about the termination, once that woman has had that termination, you don't then want to be heaping condemnation on her, and you don't want to be distressing the women with their babies. So I'd suggest that the committee just applies its mind to that and maybe investigates a little bit further. And then just a final thing. We've heard quite heated remarks about the research, particularly with breast cancer. I don't know the answer. But perhaps, and there was another issue which wasn't clearly delineated in one of the presentations, as to when a child fetus in the womb becomes sentient and feels pain. There was one comment made by 26 weeks, and then the 20 weeks and the viability were brought in, and the thread of discussion about being sentient was lost. Not for the purposes of this bill, but I'd like to suggest to the committee that at a future stage, when you have the time, commission people to submit fairly, research on both sides or across the spectrum on those factors. Okay, it's a heated, pressurized thing, and this one's criticizing that one, and people brandish their research and they brandish their research. The hearings might need to go on for a while, but because it is such a fundamental issue, that may be on issues like that, it would be worth having a proper scientific investigation where you bring the experts in. And so, really what I hope I've done, and I'm happy to field questions obviously, is just hopefully as a change of tack from a lot of the other submissions, try and nail down some of the details in the wording of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Michael John Atkins, for your submission. I was indeed thinking to myself, listening to your jumbling of the submission, that perhaps you were trying to seek to solve a mathematical equation on a legislation as complex and as humane as this one. You know, I know how mathematicians sometimes may want to solve societal problems. Sometimes it's a very serious disjunction when you come to look at those things. X times X is X squared, but the question of life is something else, you know. It's very easy. Panel members, questions? Oh, Maureen. Thank you very much. I'm so sorry. The presenter is this side.
Regulations can't be made properly, and I don't think it's a fear that I have. It's an observation, because as the Act currently stands, it says the Minister may make regulations relating to any matter, right, and goes on. So currently, obviously, the Minister can. If this is adopted with that section as it is, it would read, the member of the Executive Council may, and as you've read it. Therefore, the Minister, and this is an observation, I'm not saying it's good or bad, I'm simply saying the Minister would not then have the power to make regulations. The Minister would have the power to ensure that he or she was satisfied with any regulations made in the provinces, because the phrase is in consultation, not after consultation, right? So an MEC may make regulations only with the agreement of the Minister, right? So the minister would have the power to veto provincial regulations or amend them or make sure that they're consistent with the regulations in the other provinces, which is, as it's been pointed out. But that in consultation would not give the minister the power to originate regulations. And the minister's power is currently national regulations. The power of the MECs will be regulations that apply only within a particular province. So I think it would remain that the minister would not be able to make regulations the moment this act comes into force. And hence my other concerns about what about the existing body and the transfer of certain things to the provinces.
I think we've got our eminent lawyers here who are backing us up in this thing. Maybe let's start from the beginning for you to understand this. That's why I was saying that it's very easy for you to use your mathematical postulates here. The Constitution defines, I think it's Section 4 of the Constitution, certain powers that are concurrent. Amongst others, health is amongst those. Hence you will find the national minister and the provincial minister in quotes, I want just for ease of reference here, and the provincial minister. But the overriding power is with the national minister. That's what is important as a departure point, that's what the Constitution says. Having said that, I think that's a point Honorable Matumisa is there for raising. And you will see, let's take the principal act, maybe just, and we are going to come back to this. I think, I'm sure, you were part of a number of submissions that came here. Amongst one of the things noted by a number of people who made submissions here, was that the word used was the devolution of power to provinces will help facilitate the process of access. And thus, therefore, the according of these powers to the MECs to allow for the ease of registrations of the facilities. That's the first point here. I think that's a line of thinking you must bear in mind. Now, the principal act says the minister may make regulations relating to any matter which he or she may consider necessary or expedient to prescribe for achieving the objects of this act. And the objects of this act were therefore defined in the principal act. However, the principal act realized that there were problems of expeditious and easy access to these facilities. Therefore, give power down to the provinces for the registration of these facilities so as to expedite the efficiency of the certification and access, therefore, to termination of pregnancy facilities. Having done, therefore, recognizing this power in the regulation, then the Amendment Act, therefore, then says, you are giving your MEC, your provincial minister in this case, these powers to make regulations relating to any matter which it is necessary or expedient to prescribe for the proper administration, implementation or administration of the set. But you do so in consultation. Meaning, therefore, the original powers still reside with the minister. Get the point? Still reside with the minister. So there's no carte blanche given to the MEC to do whatever they do. There's still an oversight body residing in the minister to do those things. That's why, therefore, in the memorandum of the bill, which Honorable Matumisa has been reading, further elucidates this point on the deal referred to. Empower the MEC consent to prescribe by regulation the local and conditions applicable for purposes of consistency so that there's no inconsistencies as the provinces are doing this work, for purposes of that inconsistency, the minister must approve. Where is the problem? There's no problem. So read everything in its interconnectedness in order for us to understand these things. There's no problem here. The eminent lawyers are here, state law advisor and the departmental law advisor, can further elucidate on this point.
Honorable Chairman, may I answer what you have said?
Sorry.
Okay. Thank you, Honorable Chair. What I can say, you are dead correct on what you are saying. If you look in health service, falling in Schedule 4, which means the functional areas of concurrent competence, which means national and provincial legislature. So there's nothing wrong with the current amendment. I'm sure the purpose is to facilitate the consistency, because you must remember in South Africa we've got 9 provinces. If the MEC cannot consult with the national minister, there can be a confusion. That's the purpose of this amendment when I'm seeing it right now. Thanks, Cousin.
Thanks, Chair. Just to add, I think what is incisive and instructive on this matter is Section 25 of the National Health Act, which makes provision for provincial policies to be made in accordance with national policy. And we also have Section 100 of the Constitution, which makes provision for national intervention in provincial administration. This clause was drawn or drafted in order to avoid situations where each and every time we have a situation where provinces have a set of regulations that are in contradiction with the national policy, we invoke Section 100. But this is just to say we are preempting, in fact not preempting, we are being proactive to say that provinces must have their policies in accordance with national policy, and therefore saying that the minister will have the final say in approving all these regulations. Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Chair, I submit that the things that have been said do not answer my assertion, but I request permission to explain why. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. Not at all. Doing the regulations in consultation with the minister is perfectly logical. You'd have a big problem if you didn't do it. Okay. That is all understood. I'm just pointing something out which I don't think has yet been accepted or I don't believe has been disproved yet. Currently, the Act says the Minister may make regulations. If you pass the amendment as it is, the Act will no longer say the Minister may make regulations. Now, I'm saying there's nothing wrong with both the Minister making regulations and the MECs. And I fully understand the concurrency issues and all the intervention issues. Right? I really do understand those things. Education is another field where there's been a few issues that have arisen. The National Education Policy Act had a number of areas which there were overlapping concerns. All I'm saying is, as it is written, the minister would no longer have the power to make regulations. If you leave it like that, then you are going to have a transitional problem, because you would have to choreograph it so that the day the minister's authority to make regulations ended, that there were regulations promulgated in every province. And if you don't do that, there will be terminations taking place in those provinces that are unlawful. And you don't want to, you don't want to just leave that as a gap. You want a smooth transition and a legality with what you're doing.
Your own assumption, which is fundamentally flawed, thinks that the amendment completely displaces, to use your scientific term, completely displaces the principal act, which is not the case. Can I give the lawyers?
No. Oh, Mr. Sir, you know what I've noted, the speaker is making a confusion somehow, because he's referring to the principal act that may. In fact, to be general, if you notice, when you draft legislation, it is a standard procedure to include that may sometimes. I'm just guessing that he is having with that problem with that may. So, really, I don't know what is the actual problem, because as far as I'm concerned, that clause is correct.
We have got ample experience in these things. There's no confusion in our own view. In fact, you are reading it completely wrong. Completely wrong.
But Mr. Chair, may I respectfully ask that you get a written legal opinion on
no.
that?
There are lawyers here. Please, no advice.
I'm merely submitting a request here. I have no interest. It's a small point. And I have no interest in conflict with you. I'm not disagreeing with anything in the Act. I'm trying to point something out that I saw that could affect, and the state could be severely embarrassed if you are wrong, and if I'm right, that the embarrassment and the damage to the state could be severe. So all I'm saying is, perhaps indulge me as somebody who's being persistent and a nuisance, and check it out. If it was trivial, then it wouldn't matter. But I would not like to see the state go down that road, particularly having been warned of something.
In my own experience in dealing with legislation, Mr. Elkins, I've heard many, many such threats of legal actions when we deal with legislation. I've had many, many of them. And mind you, the Constitutional Court found nothing wrong with this legislation as a content. Found something wrong in as far as the process, mind you. And so far, there are two legal views here. And our own understanding as a collective here of legislators, we are actually disputing your own understanding of this issue. Why do you want to push that your own individual view supersedes all of us?
Mr. Chair.
Because we are wrong.
Mr. Chair.
And the problem also, you are taking the Amendment Act as completely displacing all the Principal Act. But you'd read the Amendment Act in conjunction with the Principal Act. That's a standard procedure.
Mr. Chair, may I answer the specific things that you have said?
Any other questions, Honourable Members? We're passing this one. Any other question?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, may I make one personal remark?
Okay, please, sir.
I beg your pardon, yes.
Yeah.
You spoke about you've had many threats of legal action. Please don't construe that I'm trying to threaten. That is not my intention, it is not my heart. I'm not trying to be aggressive towards you. And I would also appreciate it if you didn't belittle the speakers who are here before you, who are members of the public who have made a great effort to come, by referring to scientific and mathematical, and just And I apologize for having to address you in this manner. That, and I really regret it because I don't want to make an enemy of anybody in this room. But I think you're construing my motives incorrectly.
No. That's not. I've listened very carefully to your introduction of yourself. It was quite a giving introduction. Your wife says you are pedantic in looking into issues. You are always ensuring that laws to be written well, to be comprehensible, etc. And you've looked at these things and you've found certain problems. My responses are as a consequence. I'm not belittling anything, but my responses are as a consequence of how you introduced yourself. And I feel myself also that as you introduce yourself in these high terms and being going everything with a particular, microscope in this thing, we ourselves do so. Respectfully. This is how you are. You are saying you are pedantic, doing all these things, you wanting to be comprehensive. That's why we spent over these few hours here. In fact, we have now dealt this 1,260 minutes currently, since yesterday, dealing with 1,260 minutes. I think if you translate that into hours, it will be 10 hours. We, sitting here, being attentive to each and every person, and we respect each one of them. 1,260 minutes, 21 submissions. So please bear with us. When you are pedantic, equally so we are pedantic. Equally so we want to ensure. That's why I said to many presenters here, the power of public hearings empowers us, improves our work, improves the submission. That's why all the time the legislation that comes before us are not what is perfect. But through a process of public hearings, we produce better laws. That actually then we can say, Stephen advises, this is the view, what are the constitutionalities of this issue? And they'll say, this one is not constitutionally challengeable. And then we proceed. That's the experience we have. Respect that.
Mr. Chair, if I may just make a final remark. I really, after two long days, wouldn't like to end on a sour note. And I won't take any more time. And I would just like to say thank you to you and all the members who have sat these long hours. As I said earlier, as a citizen, it feels really good to be able to come here and sit and do this. And I sincerely meant no disrespect when I said I was pedantic. I was describing myself, not anybody else. But thank you, and if there are no more questions, then I have no more to say. Thank you.
Beg your sort of indulgence. I need to be excused. I've promised my son something, and it's running very late, and I'm leaving him stranded. And I'm off to Iran on Friday, and I'm going to leave you in the lurch with all of them. I'd love to debate and deliberate with you, but I'm not going to be here. But I will leave my submissions and everything else. So I want to say goodbye, and I'll be thinking of you all.
Thank you very much, Mr. Michael John, and thanks for the submission. And thank you for your week. We are now going to number 8.
Thank you, Chairperson, and also House Portfolio Committee members and the House at large. I also want to thank those that actually spoke about, I acknowledge IPA's role in assisting in the implementation of the CTOP Act. My name is Mosotu Gabriel. I'm a registered nurse and midwife by profession. But I'm working for an international organization, IPAS. And IPAS is working globally to increase women's sexual and reproductive health, and in particular, reduction of abortion-related deaths and injuries. I'll specifically talk about IPAS South Africa. We started working in South Africa in 1995, and I'm sure all of us will recall that it was at the time of lobbying for the new legislation, which will give equitable access to all women of this country. So over the last 12 years, IPAS South Africa provided technical assistance in training, and I know a lot has come out of training. I just want to put one comment in terms of the training that we used for termination of pregnancy. It's approved by the South African Nursing Council, and it's quite comprehensive. We also provide technical support in research to understand better and to inform policy better. For an example, in 2005, we commissioned a study to UCT on second trimester abortions, really trying to find out why women come late. And again, just as a comment to say, there are many reasons that we shouldn't take for granted in terms of why women come to us to request termination of pregnancy. In terms of policy formulation, I'll just comment a little bit about policies that we are involved with currently as we speak. There's a lot that has been said around conscientious objection. Just to indicate that, and I think Professor Mhlanga mentioned in his presentation that in 2005, we commissioned the Women's Legal Unit, our center in Cape Town, to help us develop a conscientious objection manual, because obviously it's a contentious issue, to really try and look at how to facilitate access of termination of pregnancy services. 2 years down the line, we're still encountering a lot of problems around conscientious objection, and having sat here for 2 days, it came out a lot. So I just want to indicate that we've just completed a national conscientious objection policy, which has been, which is now with the National Department of Health, and we hope as soon as it is adopted, it will be able to be disseminated to again inform and guide practice. Before I move on with the background of the IPA submission, I just want to go back a little bit about data from WHO, the World Health Organization, which Danosa alluded to in their submission yesterday. There's recent data that indicates that whether abortion is legal or illegal in all countries, the statistics are actually the same. The difference is where it is legal, it's likely to be safe and saves women from dying and from injuries. But where it is illegal, it is likely to lead to maternal deaths and injuries. And also, Danosa spoke about data that was released 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago from WHO, which gave us the current data, the latest, which is for 2003, which gave us a figure of 66,400. I'm not going to go back to that presentation, but I would like to highlight the fact that of the 66,400, hundreds were from developed countries. And the reason for that is that they've got liberal abortion laws. While they left us with restrictive abortion laws for women in our continent to be dying like flies. I just want to go back to look at the focus of the IPA South Africa's submission this afternoon. Our submission tried, and I'm not going to read it all because a lot of issues have been spoken to already, but we tried to provide a contextual background to the introduction of the Choice of Termination of Pregnancy Act. And we also tried to reflect on the implementation of the service itself, because it was important to look at, if we have this act, what are the benefits? Do we see an impact or not? Then it will move on to, we will move on to also demonstrate why IPA South Africa supports the Choice on Termination of Pregnancy Amendment Act, which was initially Act 38 of 2004. I want to remind the House that these amendments are an appropriate policy response to try and increase women's access to reproductive health services. And to say this came out of the 2002 oversight hearing, where members of civil society themselves indicated that although abortion is legal, or termination of pregnancy is legal in South Africa, services are not yet available to them. And we will conclude, of course, by restating the constitutional imperatives undermining our abortion legislation. So those are the four areas, but I'm going to be brief in terms of how the flow of our submission moves. Now, in terms of looking at the history, because for us to be able to be progressive, we cannot deny the history. Some of us were there and can give stories about what happened. But I just want to talk a little bit about the Abortion and Sterilization Act of number 2 of 1975. And people alluded to that act. What I just want to mention is the fact that while that act was so restrictive, denying majority of women to access legal termination of pregnancy, it does not actually mean termination of pregnancy was not taking place. What we had then was what was called backstreet abortion. And if one visits the figures, of course, perhaps I need to mention that the most compelling argument for abortion legislation reform was the 1994 research study that was done by National Department of Health, Medical Research Council, WHO, and other organizations. That study indicated that 44,686, that was data corrected June 1994 to June 1995, in a one-year period. The figures were 44,000, almost 45,000. Today, everybody is complaining about 50,000 per year of safe legal terminations. But actually, when you look at the two figures, they are so close. The benefit is, if you look at the 50,000 that is worrying us, they are legal and safe, therefore helping us to save lives. When we revisit the 1994 study, we then realized that out of that 45,000, actually 425 women died. So whilst we were saying we get joy out of restrictive abortion law, we were actually acknowledging what WHO is saying, to say whether it's legal or not, it's proven in all countries, the figures are almost the same. And I'm restating this in a very strong note, because the government has got a responsibility to ensure that it provides safe services to its citizens. Therefore, the Choice on Termination of Pregnancy didn't just come. It came because of the history, it came because of evidence, it came because of the stories that women told about their lives. If I had time, I could also tell my story, and many other stories. Like I said, I'm a registered nurse and midwife, and I know I worked in facilities where in the past, even when women was raped, they couldn't access an abortion because you had to have two doctors, a psychiatrist, and you can imagine in some provinces or regions then, as they were called, Transvaal or whatever, there wasn't even a psychiatrist. So in essence, you're saying a service is good enough for certain sector of your society and not good enough for others. I'll move on to then look at, whilst we enjoyed at the reform, 10 years down the line, what are the actual benefits? And again, I'm not going to talk a lot about that because a lot of people already alluded to the fact that we have seen an enormous reduction in sufferings of women. In 1999, the Department of Health commissioned a study. And actually that study, all of us said, is too early to try and measure the impact of what's happening. But there was anxiety in the country in terms of, even if it's 3 years, let's see if something is coming out. And I participated in that study, so I know myself what effect. That study indicated an immediate impact by reducing at least the suffering of women coming into hospitals with incomplete abortion at 50%. That was commendable. The most significant finding to date has been the comparison between the 1994 study and the 2002-2004 confidential inquiry into maternal deaths. And a lot of people spoke about that, which is to date 91%. All I want to comment and say is that we have become a model as South Africa. Probably we don't know. But if you're fortunate to go to international conferences or conferences in Africa, you'll hear people quoting South Africa as an example, a country that has saved its mothers by making sure that abortion services are legal and safe. Because of the influence of South Africa, Ethiopia liberalized its law in 2005. As I speak, they are busy with implementation. And we hope in the next 5 years they can enjoy the same benefits that we have enjoyed. I think one presenter indicated that we've just been to an international conference and it was joy to hear countries like Mexico saying because of South Africa, we can't believe what South Africa did by reducing the number of women from the numbers that we gave for 1994 to what we can give today, which is around 35 to 40. And it is unfortunate for me to indicate that the deaths that occurred, and Professor Mhlanga can add if maybe I'm not quoting the report properly, no deaths have been recorded in the first trimester. All deaths were recorded, the few that were recorded were in the second trimester. Again, saying we've got a responsibility as a country to do more in terms of disseminating the information to women and encouraging them to come early so that a lot of terminations can be done in first trimester. Because, of course, the more the pregnancy advances, the more it becomes difficult. I'll jump a section that speaks extensively about our role in abortion care. But I must just say, we are involved. So we're not talking from the theoretical base. We are talking from the practical base. And we are involved nationwide. So we've got quite a sense of what is happening. And a lot of people indicated how simple the procedure is in first trimester. So we need to disseminate the services to where the majority of our women are. And hence, we support the amendment. Coming to the reasons, why do we support the amendments? Again, I'm going to be very brief because we've spoken about these issues. Devolving the responsibility to the MSCs of health is obvious, it's a given, it's going to make the designation process speed it, it's going to speed it up, decentralize services to primary care level. And I must indicate that while the amendment were in action, Gauteng became a model province by making sure that all its community health services are designated. and we hope other provinces will follow suit. We also support the issue around submission of statistics. This is important, of course, that it should be mandatory to be able to help in monitoring and improving services. The issue that has been debated to a great extent is the issue of registered nurses. I must indicate myself that I'm a registered nurse, and what it takes from being registered to being registered midwife is just another additional year. And actually, the 3 years that you do as a registered nurse exposes you to quite a vast ground, that the year that you do in midwifery doesn't really add a lot except to do with the delivering of babies. And if they are given extra training, nothing will stop them to be competent. And again, one of the presenters this afternoon indicated that the course is so comprehensive itself. Many people said they don't know what it entails and how long the course is. Briefly, it's just 2 weeks theoretical base, and it's got 10 chapters. It's really comprehensive, looking at all areas of sexual and reproductive health. And then it's followed by clinical base. The clinical base is up to a period of 3 months. And your first few cases, I think up to 15, is under supervision. And you are never allowed to provide termination of pregnancy unless you've been signed as competent by a doctor supervising you or a competent registered midwife supervising you. So this is really to allay fears in terms of what does the actual training that will be given to nurses mean in terms of making them adequately equipped to be able to deal with women. So we support all those sections for many reasons that are written in the submission. Before I actually come to the conclusion, I want to touch on a few issues that were debated quite extensively yesterday and today. And one issue is counseling. And Chairperson, I'm not trying to open this up, but I just want to restate the importance of leaving it as it is. Because state-mandated counseling requirements attempt to influence rather than to inform the women about their decision, and hence use of visualization. It is so important in that legislation to talk about non-mandatory and non-directive counseling, and I'm not going to go on. It's been explained quite a bit. The next issue I want to clarify is the issue around conscientious objection. And this is also in line with international clauses. People that talk about being forced to do the procedure, I'm not too sure if they are from this planet or another planet. What I know in South Africa is you have to be trained if you are a registered nurse midwife. You express your willingness to be trained. And we've run, and we continue to run, a lot of value clarification workshops, really to help people to understand these issues, and not really to be involved, but at least to be supportive or respectful to those that chooses to be involved. However, in an emergency, and I think another presenter tried to clarify this, when a woman is coming into a facility bleeding and is likely to lose her life, that's an emergency. According to FIGO guidelines, WHO guidelines, all providers' rights becomes, you know, below that of the woman. At that time, what is important is to save the life of a woman. So those are the two things that I wanted to clarify. In conclusion, I want to really say reproductive rights has been given meaning through this legislation. And of course, it's a constitutional right. And being a constitutional right is the state's responsibility to make sure that services are in place. Undoubtedly, women's lives have been saved, women's health protected, and their status to some extent lifted. This advance has been made against an international context where the space of reproductive health and rights is shrinking. And I'm sure we all know what is happening globally. And we all know how this legislation was informed. I also want to urge the House not to forget that many women find themselves in violent relationships and or are confronted with unplanned pregnancies that result from coercive circumstances such as rape. Besides that point, I want to mention that when you counsel a woman about family planning, and I've got 10 years experience as a family planning provider and also as a manager and also training providers on IUD insertion, including just registered nurses. The first thing you tell a woman is that no method is 100%. And even WHO says that. You've got to tell the woman no method is 100%, including sterilization. Some of us have seen women coming to you for the third time, crying because they conceived on a contraceptive method and it has failed them because they omitted one injection or the IUD moved or they missed a pill. That moment, I must share with the House, is a moment for the woman alone, and nobody will ever understand that. At that point, even if you can tell the woman it's dangerous, they are likely to lose their life, they will tell you, I'll rather lose my life than continue with this pregnancy. It's a very unique moment. It's difficult to describe it. It is therefore important for South Africans who do not support this legislation to actually respect the importance of separating their own beliefs and values from the needs of others. As we've got our own values and beliefs, there are our consumers out there who need the service. If we can only learn to respect that, that will be important. The constitutional imperatives enshrined in the Bill of Rights that underpins the Choice Act are the right to equality. And I think I spoke about inequitable distribution of services before 1994 and how that was dangerous. Freedom and security of the person. Access to health care and information. The right to freedom of religion and belief. And the freedom of expression. Those are constitutional underpinning rights. And I think if we all respect them, we'll be able to treat those that come to us with dignity. As we overcome years of denying choice and human rights, I do think we have a moral obligation to protect, uphold, and advance the exercise of full human rights to all South Africans. I don't want to end off by saying, irrespective of their color, their nationality, their ethnicity, etc. But I think it's important, having listened for 2 days, how we view things. And it was for me an unfortunate experience, I must say. Because while some of us are working very hard to help the state, I sort of got a sense that some people are saying, what is government doing? Who is the government? I guess we are the government. We cannot expect a piece of legislation to have teeth and teeth and extra teeth. Because even if you can give 100 sets of teeth, if we are not going to work hard as citizens of this country, we are going to fail that piece of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gabriel. I will hand over to members to ask questions. It's quite incisive, the point you are raising. I think honorable members have listened to it very carefully. She says, in terms of this particular point that has been boxing us for the last 2 days, conscientious objection. The nurse, the registered nurse, or the midwife, for him or her to perform termination must undergo a prescribed training. And the semis therefore there is, you voluntarily go for the training. And it's a very powerful point you are raising. Because we have thought, we have taken away this particular element that you are raising. It's a very incisive point. I hope members have listened to this point very carefully. May I open for questions? What they are thinking, there's a point here, just maybe I didn't understand it properly in your submission here. On page 4, point number 5 there. Okay, let's say page 4, the paragraph that starts with in the main, the amendments are geared towards increasing women's access to safe, top services and better governance of those services. It was envisaged that this could be achieved by accelerating the process of designation of facilities to provide abortion services as provincial competency and by increasing the pool of trained providers through the extension of top training to registered nurses in order to render first trimester services. It's quite interesting, you're actually defining that particular service. For the registered nurses to render first trimester service. Yeah, that was the point that Dr. Mhlanga was raising, which is not covered properly, both in the principal act and in the amendment bill. So you are yourself saying that the registered nurse function must be limited to this particular section. Would that be right to read?
Yes, Chairperson, that's what we are saying. And I think the rationale behind that is what Professor Mhlanga was trying to say, that much as we are agreeing to increasing the pool of those that need to render first trimester abortion, but we wouldn't want to extend the registered nurses per se beyond a certain time period, and for the reason that he mentioned earlier on. And also I alluded to the fact that a general nurse does, for example, a 3-year training, and he chooses to be either also a registered midwife and you go for a further 1 year. So that further 1 year is critical in terms of maternal and child health. And hence after 20 weeks, it's ideal just for registered midwives to be involved.
So it may mean, honored members, that we'll have to look at that section, I think, in when we deliberate on the bill. We must find the way it was thus far drafted, I think it's not clear. It defines, but then it interchangeably gives those functions. I think the point you are raising, we'll have to further process this point. I think two submissions have actually highlighted this particular point. Honorable Mark Smela.
Thank you very much. Chair, on page 4 of the presentation, I just want to know from the presenter if I may take her to what Mr. Atkins has been saying around regulations, under regulations actually. That paragraph says there was a ranging period from 6 months to 3 years to approve an application by the National Minister of Health. By making the designation of top services a provincial responsibility, it reduces the time taken to 3 to 6 months. Despite shortening the period of designation, the regulations provide that facilities be inspected. And what is, in your own view, let us try to be somehow in the whole matter. In your own view, ma'am, do you think that this section on its own suffices, which says the member of the executive council may, in this case is the minister, in consultation with the minister, the member of the executive council may, do you think that may it should be there or what?
Thank you for the question, honorable member. I think it should be there. It's clear enough as it was explained. And I just want to also draw the attention of the designation process as being different from a process of developing regulation. and that it is important and regulation development that the Minister of Health nationally is the overseer. The facilities that are to be designated are within the provinces. So it's logical and a good sequence for the MEC of Health to take that responsibility, because it involves a team to go to the facility to inspect if the facility comply with requirements said and make a recommendation. Now, what was taking a long time was for all the 9 provinces to be facilitating their application to the National Minister of Health in Pretoria. And it's given the fact that ministers are busy. So you can imagine 9 provinces going out to inspect facilities and trying to get the minister to approve all of them. So we really support the issue that responsibility has been devolved to the MECs. And I think one of the presenters also made an eloquent point around we are not just collecting data for data or for collection sake, but data should ideally be analyzed and used. And it is ideally used at facility level or within the province. It needs to inform them. And I do think this data later on, I think it's once a year, gets sent to the National Department of Health. So there is still a link where the MECs of Health still links to the National Department of Health in terms of data collection. But that whole process happening at provincial level is much more effective and efficient. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Dr. Rabinowitz, I saw your hand. I know you're tired.
No, it's not a yes course. It's actually classified as a short course. So according to the South African Nursing Council requirements, during those days when we first developed the curriculum, it was a course which had about 80 hours requirement. So how we split the 80 hours was 40, which makes the 4 weeks of theoretical training, and then the other 40 of clinical training. That is after the course when they are at facilities. Now, why it stretches to 3 months? There are issues around allocation of those that have been trained to do their clinical training. There are issues around caseloads. There are issues around people who are themselves competent to be able to be a mentor to the newly trained, until the newly trained is competent. So if we could use 2 weeks as a measure for clinical training, it may not be feasible for many, many reasons. And we also know that, and I think it was also alluded to in this in some presentation, the fact that caseloads are much more higher in other provinces than in other provinces. Other provinces are really battling. And to support that, Northern Cape and Northwest, the provinces are really doing badly. I think Northern Cape is below 1% of all the national TOP beds, and Northwest is standing at about 2%. So you need to take all that into consideration, caseload, places of allocation, the mentorship, etc., etc. Hence, we give them quite a timeline. But I must also indicate that one thing which we introduced last year as IPAS, which we really think is very, very useful, is what we call trainee follow-up, which is monitoring and evaluation after training, where we ourselves, with the province involved that has just conducted the training, we really follow up the person that we trained in terms of ensuring that they are really allocated to clinical training, they are really supervised, and they are really signed off, and sort of measure in a 6-month period to see if the training has sort of made an impact in terms of, you know, if you invest in training, you would want those people to come back and render the service that they were trained for. So we've introduced that last year, and it's working very well. We do have the follow-up reports, which is the first that we had produced. And one of the interesting things in that report that came out is the fact that 95% of women that had terminated for the group that we are following up all had received their post-abortion contraceptive counseling, which in a way defeats a lot of theoretical talk around doubting if counseling takes place or not. Because if nobody was talking to this woman, I don't think they would be able to choose even a method of contraception. And I think a final comment would be on training. It will be very useful for members of the committee to maybe see the manual that is used for training and to see this conscientious objection, the strategic plan, because those things are so informative in terms of addressing a lot of questions and queries that I had being debated around in the 2 days that I've been here. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your endurance. I think you've been here since yesterday. And for your page, so somebody wanting to respond? Honorable Mattel? Oh, sorry, I was just closing.
I just want to find out, are there a significant amount of or percentage of people performing top functions currently that are not trained medical professionals, nurses or midwives?
Thank you for that question. To our knowledge, I would say no. In terms of in facilities which are officially designated, only trained providers are placed to provide services. The reason I'm saying yes and no is because we also know that we see in papers that there are people that advertise themselves as providers of legal TOPs whilst they are not designated, and hence we welcome particularly the penalty clause in the amendment that is going to give the provincial departments of health something that they can use to be able to follow up. So as I speak to you, I can't for sure say there are not people out there that are taking advantage of the situation. But in the official term, I'll tell you that every designated facility is only a trained midwife or doctor that is providing services. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm not sure.
Yes, and thank you for that question, because it's very, very important for breaking the cycle of abortion. In our training, there's a whole day committed just to post-abortion contraceptive counseling and massage giving. And we insist on a facility to have methods on-site, not to terminate and refer women to cross and go to another facility, even if it's within the same yard. So all facilities that are providing termination of pregnancy have got methods to provide to a woman. What I must mention is they will provide that method, but refer the woman for the return method to go to the facility nearer their home or a facility where they have been using before maybe they became pregnant. But the initial method is given after a TOP at the facility after counseling. And they are easily available. As we know, the contraceptive prevalence in South Africa is quite high, so methods are available everywhere. Thank you.
Any other question? Dr. Planga?
Sorry, Chair, thank you for allowing me. I know I'm not allowed to
make this point, but I thought that this is the portfolio committee is it's an important committee that oversees the function of the Department of Health and what our government and others provide services. I think on the issue of the contraception, there is currently some concern, not only in the clinics, but even within the tertiary institutions, where there has been, I think, a misinterpretation that family planning is only for primary health care, for primary health care level services, so the clinics. However, because of that, there has been a shift, and family planning services are being closed down in the tertiary and even secondary level hospitals. I guess hospital managers saying that, well, we cannot continue funding something that is supposed to be funded at primary health care level, which places a very big problem in that the women who are at high risk, who go to the secondary and tertiary institutions for other conditions, then do not have access to expert advice and service in terms of their contraception, and therefore are more prone to then die from a pregnancy, should they fall pregnant, because they didn't either have time to go to the primary healthcare level for the family planning needs, or the primary healthcare level says, so sorry, the drugs that you are taking are so complex, we don't know how they're going to interact with the contraceptives or any other methods that we're going to give you, so go back to that institution. And so this is something that I think even as we debate the amendments and the committee considers the amendment to also be aware that it has to go together hand in hand with strengthening the family planning services. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, honorable members. I see there's no more hands coming. We have completed, the submissions, public hearings on the choice on termination of pregnancy amendment bill. As I was saying earlier on, that has taken us now well above the 1,260 minutes. In fact, I calculated to say it's 11 hours. I think it's 22 hours above. You divide 1,260 by 60. I think it gives you 22. Am I right? Yeah. So, sorry? And I think, honorable members, I think it was quite a very useful process, quite informative. A number of areas we will have to come back to as we process the bill. I think it has been highlighted by a number of people that made their submissions yesterday and today. We'll have to see how we come back to those things, ranging from conscientious objection. We'll have to pronounce ourselves there, to the issues on counseling, to the issues, I think, on registered nurses, issues on the questions of the facilities and the registration of facilities, and all other issues that were actually raised by a number of presenters that actually raised these issues here. But I must indeed, in particular, thank members for the diligence and alertness in the manner in which I think we dealt with the submissions. That were quite difficult and sometimes quite charged, because we are moving from different strands. Some were coming with a very strong conviction that my religion doesn't allow it, and to a very strong strand to people to say, let's forget about our religious subjectivities. Let's look at the public health challenges that are facing us. It was all of us, may we in one way or another well, submission to that faith. We may have all our different faiths, but there's a public health challenge that is facing us. Let's see how we deal with those issues. And I think for us, that is the most critical focus. It was not about our religious inclinations, our religious strengths and the other things, but to what extent are we going to intervene as legislators and policy makers to a fundamental challenge that is planning itself here outside. I really want to thank sincerely all members that have come from the public to make their submissions here yesterday, and some of them have been enduring with us here. Some of them became our own experts in terms of assisting us here. Marion Stevens, people from the University of Cape Town, Dr. Marek Albers, etc. I think it has been quite a useful presentation. So tomorrow, honorable members, at 2 o'clock, we are dealing with the Traditional Health Practitioners Bill, public hearings. So please, I know you are tired. We have to complete this process, and then next week on Tuesday, we have to start the processing now of all these submissions that came in order for us to come to the process. We'll have to find a way. We'll have to first complete the bill on the termination, I think. Having completed that one, and then go to another one, maybe sometime in the same week. Please prepare yourselves again for the same processes that are going to put a lot of challenge on your own energies, etc. So that at least, because as you know, that the Constitutional Court has given certain prescripts about this legislation. So we have no choice. Please bear in mind that this is not our choice. On the 18th of February, if we don't pass the legislation, the Constitutional Court will make its own determination. And I think it will be an abdication of responsibility on our part if we do so. So please, I really request a lot of caffeine to be drank in order for us to be alert and deal with these things. Thank you very much, in particular, to also members of the department, members of the state law advisors. I think for your diligence, alertness in the manner in which you were really of great assistance to us in dealing with these issues. I hope we have taken note of all the issues raised with the public, by the public rather, so that when we deal with these issues, we are more systematic in ensuring these things that are actually done in this particular way. And not that members of the public are not allowed when we process this business. If any one of us feel that you still want to be there, please feel free to still attend to hear what we're saying. Sometimes maybe I do know sometimes it also helps us to always refer back to you to advise us or to help in the drafting of a particular clause. That's what we do. So don't feel that your role has ended now. If you feel you've got time, you want to still be part of the processing, the policy of Parliament in our new dispensation, is that those processes are open to all of us. Please feel free, therefore, if you feel you want to attend, you do so. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you very much, members of the department. I'm sorry to those who missed their flights. I know we have to demand some of these things. My sincere apologies to themselves. Thank you very much.
Hello.